You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, episode number 580. I'm of the mind that life is a risk. Every time you leave your house, it's a risk. I see no reason to go through life with my hands tied behind my back for any reason. I'd be foolish to let something stop me from doing what I love to do. Thomas Jane.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Today's show is sponsored by Enigma Elements. As filmmakers, we're always looking for ways to level up production value of our projects and speed up our workflow. This is why I created Enigma Elements, your one-stop shop for film grains, color grading LUTs, vintage analog textures like VHS and CRT images, smoke, fog textures, DaVinci Resolve presets, and much more. After working as an editor, colorist, post, and VFX supervisor for almost 30 years, I know what film creatives need to level up their projects. Check out EnigmaElements.com and use the coupon code IFH10 to get 10% off your order. I'll be adding new elements all the time. Again, that's Enigma, E-N-I-G-M-A, Elements.com. Today's show is also sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films, from predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them. The odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success. The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com.
Well, guys, you are in for a treat today. We have on the show the legendary actor, Thomas Jane. Now, Thomas has been in a few movies you might have heard of, like Boogie Nights, Magnolia, Face Off, Terrence Malick's The Thin Red Line, his first big film, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, which was great, The Punisher, The Mist, HBO's Hung, Deep Blue Sea, the Amazon show The Expanse, The Predator, and so many more. Just go, the list goes on and on. And I wanted to get Tom on the show because we always talk about bankable stars and what they're looking for and how to approach a bankable star, someone who can actually get your film financed. And Thomas and I had one of the rawest and most open conversations about the film business I think we've ever had on the show. Tom was completely forthcoming about what he's looking for, how to approach an actor of his caliber, how to package a deal, and so, so much more. And we also talk about his new project, Tropo, his production company, Redicant Entertainment, and so much more. So you guys need to strap in for this episode. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Thomas Jane. I'd like to welcome to the show Thomas Jane. How you doing, Thomas?
Hey, good to see you. Hello.
Good to see you, good to see you too, my friend. I'm excited to have you on the show. I've been a fan of yours, my friend, from back in the day. So I appreciate you coming on, and I'm excited to talk to you about your new projects and the new stuff that you're doing in the world. But before we get into all of that,
yeah,
why in God's green earth did you want to get into this insane business?
Wow. There's a question. Why did I want to? I think it's a kind of business that's sort of like you don't really have a choice. I mean, I think if you could do anything else, coming up as a young actor, Anybody in my acting classes that had a plan B, you know, whether it was managing a restaurant or going to night school to be an accountant, that's what they ended up doing. So one of the first things I learned was no plan B.
You burned the ships at the shore.
You got to. I mean, otherwise you're going to, there are nights when you lay awake in bed at night, staring at the ceiling and going, why the hell am I here? And what the hell did I think I was doing? There are those nights, you know, and if you've got that, you know, escape hatch, sooner or later, you're going to get weak and take it. So yes, you got to burn the ships, man. There's no way out.
So let me ask you a question then. I mean, look, as an actor, I'm always fascinated by, you know, when I'm directing and I'm doing a casting, I try to be as kind as I can to actors, but they get rejected 99% of the time, especially when they're coming up, if not 100% of the time when they're coming up. Right. How did you deal with rejection coming up? How did you just keep going and grinding every day when there was nothing on the horizon that said, if you stick with this, you're going to make it?
Yeah.
You know, how did you do it?
There's only one way to do it, and that's to love what you do. I started a little theater company here in Los Angeles in the bad part of town on Heliotrope and Melrose. We rented out in literally a store space, and we called it The Space, and we built our own. We got our seats from some abandoned theater, and we built the tiers, and I think it sat 49 people. And we built our stage and put up some lights, and we started directing, acting, writing. Even I did a one act play there that I wrote. And you get a group of guys together that just really love it, you know, and we're all doing it for free. You know, tickets were negligible, if not free, you know, and you get all your buddies to come on one weekend, and the second weekend, there'll be three people and one of them will be asleep in the audience.
And snoring.
I've been there. Yeah. But if you love what you do and it's like, well, where can I do this? And even if I have to invent my own place to do it, you know, and that leads to friends and some other guys got another theater. And really I did a lot of theater in LA, and you don't think of LA as a theater town, but There's a little bit going on. There's a great theater called The Odyssey down in Laguna Beach. Mm-hmm. That's a union theater. I did a play there with Sherry North, who used to be called the smart Marilyn Monroe back in the day. I kept that up. I haven't done theater in a long time because I've been busy doing this, but I'd love to get back to it. So the question and the answer is love what you do. And if you love what you do, you'll find a way to do it. And it doesn't really matter. And, you know, I ultimately said to myself, you know, it doesn't really matter if I never get paid for this. I love to do it. Mm-hmm. I love what it does. And I love to watch it. You know, I love to go to theater. I became an usher at a theater in Century City just so I could go and watch the play every night, you know, and watch the different changes and how it was the same but different every night. I was a bad usher because I was kept watching the play instead of showing people to their seats, but
other than ushering. when you get your first gig as a paid actor on a movie or a TV show, what was that like just going on the set for the first time, knowing that you got to remember some lines, and even it could have been just one line, but just being there, what was that like for you? And did you throw up? Did you have imposter syndrome? All that kind of stuff.
All of the above. It's a new experience for sure. But, you know, I started out, my first experience on set was as an extra in a Lorenzo Lamas movie. We're talking about like the
90s. 80s.
Maybe it was late 80s, something like that. And I played soccer in the background of some scene that they were shooting, right? Uh-huh. And watching Lorenzo Lamas do he had this towel and he would puff up his biceps before each shot, you know, and I was like, well, that's interesting. And just watching the crew, watching the people is all new to me. I had no idea what anybody's job was, but they sure were busy. And then at the end of the day, you line up at this makeshift table where they would hand out your paycheck. And when I when I got over there, they'd packed up and gone. So, you know, I was only supposed to get like $40 or something. But you know, that $40 meant a lot. That pissed me off. So I like doing productions where people actually pay the people that work and respect the different jobs that people do. You know, then I started getting, I guess maybe it was Buffy the Vampire Slayer, where it was like a real movie. And I had a few, I had a scene with Luke
Perry.
And I played this garage mechanic and he's kind of crazy. And that was really my first experience of getting into the makeup trailer and just being thrown through the works in the process and on to set and doing your scene and the coverage and all that. And yeah, it's exhilarating and terrifying and fascinating and everything you'd think it would be. I remember Luke was in his makeup trailer and he was talking to his agents on the phone and they were arguing because he had this, what he called a jazz button. He had this little
flavor saver.
Yeah. And it was clean shaven except for that. And he was arguing with the producers and the agent about whether or not he was going to keep it or shave it off. Of course they wanted him to shave it off. He ended up keeping it.
It was funny because I knew I knew Fran, the director of Buffy. Years ago, I hung out with her and she would tell me stories about what it was like being on that set and running it. I think it was her second movie or something like that. And it was a studio movie. And
what a neat group of people.
Oh, and Luke Perry was like at the height of his power. I mean, he was the star of that, you know, even though it was Christie's, you know, she was the Buffy, but people don't understand. Yeah, I mean, I lived in Orlando. I lived in Florida when that mall that he went to go visit, there was a riot. And like people.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
I drove by that day. I was like, what's going on over here? I was living in Fort Lauderdale at the time. And it was so people didn't understand how big of a star he was back then. So that must have been a hell of an experience just being around that.
Yeah. And I met a lot of people on that set. David Arquette. Paul Rubens, we're still friends today.
It was a great set. It was a great group of people, that film. Now, speaking of some films, I mean, you've worked with a couple of good directors, just a couple over the years. You've had the pleasure of working with like Terrence Malick and P.T. Anderson and John Woo. Did you learn any lessons from about filmmaking that you brought into your directing, into your producing years later, or just as an actor? What are some lessons you learned from some of these great filmmakers?
Always, you know, they all got different styles. I learned that. I learned that there's no one way to do it. And I'm always paying attention because I do love directing and producing, and I've always been headed in that direction. Once you get a little experience, you know, I feel like I have something to offer and avoid some of the pitfalls that I've fallen into in the past and have seen people fall into. It's really nice. It's neat to, it's an oral tradition, you know, that you can read some books, but there's only one way to really learn how it happens. And that is to do it. And you're learning hand to mouth, mouth to ear. It's people teaching other people how to do it. And that process for acting has gone back 2,000 years. For filmmaking, it's gone back 100 years more. But you've got, and it's technicians and artists teaching other technicians and artists. And I love that tradition. You know, there's no other way to learn it except for to be there and to learn it from people who learned it from somebody else. And for as far as those guys, you know, I love Terry Malick's style. It was very open. He was very open to the environment and to what the actors were doing. And he would be able to shift. He was fluid. He was extremely fluid in the way that what he wanted. He would change his mind. I had this scene on a hill. It was one scene, and he'd asked me to be in the movie three times before, and I was busy doing other stuff. And then finally, I was free. And so I flew all the way over there. I flew with Mickey Rourke. Mm-hmm. And we had to take like three planes. And Mickey kept getting lost. And I felt like I was kind of babysitting. He hates flying, apparently.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
So I was kind of taking care of Mickey, and then I went over and I got to watch Mickey. So, of course, I wasn't working, but Mickey was doing his stuff one day, and I showed up and all day long watched Terry and Mickey, and Mickey was doing improv, and he improv'd all day. Beautiful monologue, gorgeous work. Didn't end up in the film, but my scene did. And I tell you, we started at dawn and we shot the scene. And then throughout the day, there'd be cloud cover and he'd shoot the scene. And then there'd be sunshine and he'd shoot the scene. Now, I knew just enough at that time to be able to ask him, like, how are you going to cut this together? We're shooting in the sun. We're shooting in the shade. You've got us at dawn. How is any of this going to match? And he said, you know what? I'm covering the scene so that I can take all of the cloud cover shots and put the scene together, and I'll have, or I can take all the sunshine shots and put those together, or I can have, we shot at dusk and dawn, I can have a magic hour scene, because that way I can put the scene anywhere in the film that I like, because it's a kind of a standalone little scene. So it's not really connected to any other part of the story. I thought that, okay, that's kind of brilliant. And then halfway through the day, he disappeared for like 3 hours. Him and John Toll just ran off. And we're sitting around for 3 hours. He finally comes strolling back. I go, hey, where you been? And he said, oh, I saw some beautiful butterflies. We were just over there, and we were filming them. Anyway, where were we?
He literally just went off to chase some butterflies. Oh my God, that's amazing.
Literally.
It's. So,
I've learned a lot from different folks. John Woo, he had a funny way, because this was a movie he was shooting in America. He had an American crew. He was out of his element. He wasn't with his normal guys doing a John Woo movie. He was doing a Hollywood movie hired because he's John Woo. John Woo is very smart. He speaks fluent English, but during the show, he pretended that he didn't speak any English. So when the producers are trying to talk to him, he'd be like, huh, what are they saying? And then he had this interpreter, and the interpreter would be trying to explain. And so he had this out. He built this out for himself where he just did whatever the hell he wanted. And if the producers got upset, be like, sorry, he was just a misunderstanding. John doesn't speak English. You know, we're doing the best we can. And I thought, OK, that's pretty clever.
But did you know on set that he didn't speak English?
I watched him, and I watched all the interpreting and all this stuff. And he had his little Chinese group around him that were very protective. And it was, I was able to, somebody told me at the end of the day, I was made friends with somebody who was on John's team. And he told me the real deal.
Oh my God. That's cause John, I mean, watching, it was Face Off, if I'm not mistaken, correct?
Yeah.
So, a classic John Woo film, and they need to make a sequel of it as soon as humanly possible. That was a lot of fun. But, I mean, he's just one of those directors, you know, he rewrote how action movies were made after he came out.
That's right. He sure did. Everything's never the same after the Bullet Ballet.
Oh, my God. After Hard Boiled and the other one he did, The Killer. Oh, just...
The Killer. I love
Bullet in the Head.
What's the star? Who did he keep using?
Oh, Chow Yun Fat.
Oh, God. He was great.
Oh, he was. Oh.
What a face, you know? He didn't have to do anything. It was just one of those faces. It's like Toshiro Mifune, you know? You're just fascinated by this guy. I'm watching, I've watched all the Kurosawa stuff, but it turns out Mifune did more movies with this Japanese director called Inaki. I think it's called Inaki. Mm-hmm. And he did more movies with this guy in Japan, but those movies never really made it outside of Japan. They were very Japanese. Mm-hmm. And his work with this guy is just as good as Kurosawa in a different way. But have you seen the Samurai trilogy?
Yeah, I remember the Samurai trilogy. Yeah. Oh, it's amazing.
I just watched that recently and I hadn't seen it. It's like a 6-hour movie divided up into three films.
Yeah, it's on Criterion. It's a Criterion Collection. Yeah.
And it's the story of Musashi, who was the most famous samurai. And it's sort of his journey from being this ruffian, this kid, this wild child kid, to being a real samurai and his journey along the way. And it took 6 hours to tell the story. It's now up in my top five. I love the way and it's so simply done. And I love those older films where they just hang on a shot, you know, they're not doing all these cuts. And when they cut into a close-up, it means something. You're like, whoa, they would let a whole scene play out just in the master, you know, and the actors would be choreographed. So they'd be moving. I love that kind of work. And I'm just hoping that I can do some of that kind of work and that people don't get bored. You know, I think that we need, I think it's desensitizing all of the television cutting that's sort of permeating our world right now and has been for years and years, but now it's sort of sunk into it. It's like everything has become it. You know, there used to be a difference between television editing and movie editing. And now you've got pretty much everything's TV. And I think somebody, maybe me, is going to turn that on its head again, where we just let it play because the actors are damn interesting. The story's interesting. I can see everybody. I see what they're doing. You know, if you got a wide shot or a medium shot, I see all the expressions on your face. I pick it up. And I think that we need, as an audience and as we move through time and society, we need things to kind of wake us up a little bit. You know, mm-hmm. You have to break out of the pattern a little bit in order to wake people back up to the power and the glory of cinematic storytelling.
Now, when you're working as an actor, what do you look for in a director? You know, how do you like to be directed? What is that, those elements that when you're thinking about doing a project, you're like, this is not going to work out because we're not going to mix here. Or I really am looking, this guy doesn't know what he's doing. Or this girl doesn't know what she's like. I'm assuming at this point you can sense this as a sixth sense now. So what is that thing that you're looking for in a director?
Oh, you know, I can take care of myself now. So I used to want a director who could really, who was going to get the best performance out of me. I found that those are few and far between. Mm-hmm. It's just sort of becoming a lost art where directors really understand. There's a few of them out there, but as far as working with actors, I got that covered. I can take care of my performance. What I'm hoping and looking for is, can you take care of your directing? So I like, if somebody comes to me with storyboards and says, this is how I'm going to shoot this. This is my vision for this thing. And if they don't say anything, you're like, well, you're just going to show up and make it up on the day, which unfortunately I have, you know, work we've all worked with. It's like, oh, we'll figure it out. And by the way, that can work. That's a, you know, that's
if,
a style.
If Ridley Scott shows up and says, hey, we're just going to figure it out on the day, you're good.
Right. You trust that. But and that can work. But I like a director to be prepared and to have a point of view and to involve me in that story. You know, how are we going to tell that? How can I help you tell the story that you want to tell? So I'm being folded into a grander picture, not just showing up and, you know, we'll make it up on the day. It's what you're looking for is a vision. You're also looking for a sensitivity to the acting, you know, and you don't have to direct it. Some of the best directors I've worked with don't say anything. They don't direct you. Their direction is extremely minimal. You know, things like a little bit faster can mean the world in a scene. Generally, directors want to say as little as possible to their actors, but to know that you're being taken care of means to be know that you're being watched, that you're they're paying attention. They're intently focused on what you're doing and they see everything. So a director comes up after a take and goes, that pause you took before you picked up that fork, fantastic, and then walk away. So I'm being able to piece together what's working and what's not working with little comments like that.
Yeah, because when you get I've been on set with very insecure directors, and insecure directors are yellers, and they're trying to, you know, boast their ego and all this kind of stuff. And I've always found that the quieter the director, the more secure they are. It's the quiet ones that you'd really, with one word, faster, more intense. Those couple words. That's
by the time, if a good director has done his job, by the time you get to set, the movie's already made. Mm-hmm. You're just executing the motions and all the crew knows what to do. Everybody, there's little adjustments to make throughout the day, but there's been production meetings that have been very thorough and everybody knows exactly what's required on that day and what this scene is about. You know, like Lumet said, he's like, I sit everybody down and we all have to be making the same movie. You know, and that's the conversation during production meetings is what kind of movie are we making? Because you can make any kind of movie. You can take a script and turn it into you can take the darkest film and turn it into a comedy or vice versa. It's the page really is a skeleton, you know, and no matter how good the script is, you're looking at a skeleton that can be interpreted and built in many different ways. So if you've got a group of 20 artists, you know, they're all going to kind of have their own proclivities and ideas and stuff. And if you just let them run, you're going to get you're going to get a Frankenstein movie. But if you're able to coalesce and everybody's making the same film, and then when they come to set and they have a question, you can remind them and say, nope, that's not the movie. And so you're just nudging people onto the path. Right. As opposed to just, you know, running away. Well, there's 20 different ways we could get to town, you know.
Exactly. Now, you know, being an actor of your caliber and being in the business for as long as you have, I'm imagining that you get pitched projects all the time from filmmakers, from producers who want you to be a part of their show or be part of their movie or something along those lines.
Knock on wood.
Knock on wood. That keeps happening, right? And you deserve it because you are, you know, you've built a hell of a career for yourself and done some amazing work. But, you know, being in the indie space and you know, now you're working a lot in independent projects as well that are, you know, outside of the $300 million studio system, though you do those every once in a while as well.
I really enjoy the indie space. I really do.
What is the proper way that someone could put a package together to entice an actor of your caliber? Like what elements should be in place? What elements shouldn't be in place? Don't do this, do this. Because there's so many, I consult constantly to independent filmmakers and they'll just do the, you know, the ignorant things that they just don't understand. Like, you can't reach out to Thomas without some money in place. That's step one. I don't care how beautiful the script might be. His agents are not going to even look at it unless there's verifiable funds, things like that. So yeah, what are some of the things, some tips you can give some filmmakers out there?
Well, it all starts with the script, you know, obviously. You've got to have a script that's going to be attractive. And there's a number of different ways. There's an endless amount of ways you can pull that off, but you got to have a script that's attractive. You got to have a script that's meaningful to actors. The most important things, like you said, is that the film is set up or there's financing that is ready to be in place. You know, most financiers will say, okay, I'll commit to making this movie if you bring me Thomas Jane. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so you can, you, there's a meeting, you know, in the middle where, you know, so you don't necessarily have to be fully financed, but you have to have the means to be financed. You have to, so it really is a director. You're starting with the money, you know, you need your producers and you need your money. And in that way, you can start to build your package. You know, I think everything's becoming a package these days. It's about who you're pairing with. So when you're crafting your script, make sure you have more than one good part, because the guys who are able to get a whole movie financed, they've got scripts lined up around the block waiting for them. They could pick any movie they want, you know, and
we'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
So that's not a good route. I mean, you're going to get in line. It's going to be three blocks down that way. Mm-hmm. But if you put a pack, if you have a film and a script, you put it together and you've got a number of different neat parts, and it could be just a 2-day part, you know, a really fun part that works for 2 days. Those work really well. And that's how you're able to attract an actor. I won't read. There's just too much stuff. You know, I just mm-hmm. don't have time to read stuff that doesn't have any financing or nobody's looked at it. However, as a producer now, I've started a company called Renegade, mm-hmm. and Troppo, our TV show for Amazon, is our first project. It's really exciting. Mm-hmm. And we do read scripts. You know, we read script. We're looking for great scripts so that we can then take it out to the financiers and start to put that together. So that's sort of your first stop. The first stop would be Renegade.
Obviously, send it into my production company, which is very, very cool of you to like, you've launched this new company and you're doing some really cool projects with the company yeah. as well. And you're taking kind of more control as an actor. Mm-hmm. over the work that you're doing. So you're not just, you know, a gun for hire. You're actually trying to put
that's
this
right. together. And I'm also, not everything that we do has to be starring Thomas Jane, you know? So it's not a Thomas Jane production company. It's a real production company. We started in 2019. So we're just getting started, because then the pandemic hit right away.
Right.
One of the first things we grabbed was Stephen King's From a Buick 8.
I know. I saw that.
That's really exciting. So many people have tried to crack it as a film. John Carpenter, can't remember the other names, but a lot of people have come on and tried to nail that down but it's too long form to, it needs to be a miniseries. Mm-hmm. So we've got some really good partners in place to turn that into a miniseries. And that's one of the things we've got. And then the Troppo book came across our desk. That was one of the first things that come around. So looking for books, looking for projects, looking for material. That's the fun. That's really fun, you know, like, oh, this could be. And then shepherding that material in a way that so that it doesn't get compromised or damaged along the way,
right?
Which is probably the toughest job in Hollywood, you know, besides writing. Writing the script is the toughest job. Second toughest job is being able to take a decent piece of material and shepherd it from A to Z without completely altering it so that it's unrecognizable, or you know, twisting it in a way that it turns into something that's not what you intended or what you fell in love with at the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's, I mean, and you as a, you know, someone who's shepherding a project like that, you are the protector of the material.
That's right.
You are the protector of the material, and you have to be a strong guardian. And a lot of times filmmakers get, you know, producers will come in, or the studio will come in, or someone else will start pushing it around to the point where you've lost control of it, and now you're not protecting it anymore.
There's so many different ways that things can go off the rails, and you need to make decisions that do change things a bit, especially if you're going from a book to the screen, from page mm-hmm. to screen. You need to make adjustments, you know, and the adjustments that you make, you have to always keep in the forefront of your mind. Does this serve the core of this project, or is it compromising it in some way? And then there will be compromises, you know,
every day of every second, there's a compromise. The whole filmmaking process is compromise.
Right. It's making the right compromises. And then it's making compromises that in turn protect the thing that you love the best about it. Right. So identifying that and being able to when you make those compromises, make sure that they're still serving what you love about the project in some way, you know? So you can, there's certain things that you can lose and still not compromise your project. There are certain things that you can change and you've ruined it.
Oh, one little thing. You lifting that fork a little too fast, the whole movie's gone off the rails.
Well, I mean, the scene might go off the rails.
No, but you know, it's like a butterfly flaps its wings and there's a you know, an avalanche somewhere. kind of thing.
When everything has a reverberation and, you know, yeah. It comes from experience, knowing what kind of compromises you can make and how and what you're protecting, what you can't compromise.
Now, as far as that package you were talking about before, I mean, verifiable funds, or at least being able to verify those funds, how important to you is the creative packaging team, like the producers involved, the director, if it's a first-time director, you know, because I know a lot of actors who just won't work with first-time directors because they just don't have the time to take that risk on their either their career or their time or any of that stuff. So how important is that team? And also, I mean, obviously your co-stars who you're going to be working with and so on. And I'm asking these questions because a lot of filmmakers out there listening don't understand the realities of what it really takes to get a film off the ground, especially in today's world. So I wanted to come straight from the horse's mouth, if you will.
Well, if you're a first-time director, I would start small. Find a project that you can make that's your calling card. You know, don't go try to get a bunch of big actors in your first time movie. It's getting rarer and rarer. Yeah. And for a reason, you're right. We don't have the time and we just don't want to take the risk. I mean, the chances are your movie is going to be pretty flawed if you're a first time director, you know, and that's just the way it is. But if you're making a film that you can't, and now it's so easy, you know, if you can put together that's your calling card. And if somebody shows me that and goes, hey, check this out, hopefully not a short, but a short, you can still get an idea of what a director is capable of through a short. And, you know, there might be some time if I had a really fantastic script and I had a great short and the part was great, then I might take that risk. But if one of those three isn't there, I just don't have time, you know?
Right.
Starting small as a director, you know, so that you can create something that's exciting and then the producers will be able to go around town and say, look, man, this guy made this in 6 days. Imagine what he'll do if we give him 18, you know, and that becomes a selling point. But as far as what would you like to know?
Well, what you just said, like those three elements, like great script, great part, great short film is an anomaly. It happens once in a blue moon. And then also there's the personality aspects, the can I sit in a room with this or can I be on a set with this person for 12 to 18 hours sometimes, depending on the project? Those are those elements as well about what entices an actor like yourself to be part of a project. And again, I'm just trying to really hammer home to filmmakers who are listening that this is the reality. Cause I hear it every day, Thomas, every day. I hear filmmakers who like, hey, you know, who's going to be perfect for this? It's going to be Thomas J. And I'm like, okay, great. What do you have? And they're like, I've got this script. What have you done? Nothing. Do you have any money? Almost money's going to drop. I'm like, no. Do you have verifiable funds? Do you have a qualified investor? No. Okay. Right. Do you have an agent? Don't have an agent yet. Do you have a lawyer? We're looking for one. But you see, but this is the delusion of a lot of independent filmmakers because they're ignorant to the process. And that's what my show is all about, is trying to really guide them through the process. So I can at least cut a couple years off of their learning lessons and not waste 2 years trying to get to your agent, trying to get a script to your agent, and then getting angry. I'm like, oh, Hollywood doesn't understand my genius.
That script, you want to put that in a drawer, and then you want to make the one that's going to get you in the door. You know, we really is, you know, it's show and tell around here. There's, you know, people talk bullshit all day long. And some people are really good at it. Some people make a career at it.
I've met the same people, sir.
But if you can do it once, you can do it again. You can make, and you and start with a financing, you know, start with, and that, I guess, you know, in a lot of ways, the producing part really is tough, because finding somebody who can recognize what a good script is or recognize what a talented director is. And I think that's one of the frustrations of people starting out. You know, it's like, if only they knew how brilliant I am.
Show us,
you know, it's show and tell. And that can be a short film, but you know, if you can put together and what's great about it is doing something like that is it could be a half hour long, it could be 45 minutes long, an hour and 5 minutes, you know, you're not beholden to any kind of rules except for making something really damn interesting. Now, holding somebody's attention on a really low budget thing for an hour is miraculous.
No, there's no question.
For a half an hour, it's miraculous. If you're going to make a short, keep it under 10 minutes. You know, and those rules are made to be broken. But, you know, if I see a short, you know, and it's 45 minutes long, I'll watch some of it. Mm-hmm. But the chances are really small that I'll get through the whole thing.
Right, exactly. Because 45 minutes short, I'm like, just keep going.
But you need a combination. You can't just make a brilliant short film and show it. You need that combination, you know, and
that's great. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think building your team early is good. You know, find ways to hook up with really talented writers, young, because the young writers, when I was coming up, I was fortunate enough to find some really talented writers who are now making livings as screenplay, but we were living hand to mouth. But we love what we did. So we would get together at night after our day jobs and we'd spend 3-4 hours writing together, you know, and developing stuff. And that really, those scripts, if I look back at them today, they're not very good, but there's moments of brilliance in them, you know, and that's how you kind of cut your teeth. That's how I cut my teeth was. And I did short films. I got to tell you, I wish somebody would dig these up. I did films for UCLA, USC. I would go and I would audition. And, you know, these graduate filmmakers, directors, they needed to make their thesis film, you know, and it was usually a short. And I did like 4 or 5 of them and had a great time, you know, and met all kinds of wonderful people. But really, you know, we were cutting our teeth. So I did short films. I wrote with young writers who they're not expecting to get paid, you know, but they love it too. They're learning too. They want to do it. And then, you know, if you're lucky enough, you'll meet some really interesting young producers. And making those connections is great, but cutting your teeth on an actual project that everybody's just doing because they need to do it, I think is the most important thing.
Yeah, you've got to. It's one of those. This is an art form that needs to be. If you want to paint, paint. You want to play music, play music. You can't just talk about it so much or intellectualize it until you're
on set. Well, like you said, it's mouth to ear, man. It's the only way to do it.
Yeah, and until you're on set and shrapnel is being tossed at you, literally and figuratively sometimes.
Yeah.
You'll learn on the first day when you're directing and you're losing the light and you've got 3 pages left. And there's no
way. Nobody's coming back tomorrow. Everybody's going home.
And we lose the location at 6.
That's right.
That's the stuff they don't teach you at school. That's
then
the stuff that
you're thinking on your feet, you know.
Then you're like, okay, how can I cover this scene in the next 15 minutes that I'm not going to lose the scene and I can save
or my how movie? Can I rewrite it so that I get the essence of what's being done? And then a lot of times that'll turn out better than your 3-minute scene.
Right. I always love going on set, especially when I'm working with the first AD the first time. I come in and I'll have a shot list of like 100 shots for the day. And he's like, you know, we're not going to get to them. Like, absolutely. I know we're not going to get to this, but I want them there in case things are going well, or maybe I can switch here. But I'd like to have that there. So just, and that's experience. Because the first time I went on set with that list, I expected to do all of it.
You do all of it. Yeah. You're like, well, why not?
Why can't we do 200 setups? It's 200 setups in 8 hours.
I got it all worked out.
I saw this behind the scenes documentary of Tarantino. I think it could work out fine. Now there is.
So, Are your guys just starting out, or are they young professionals and they're trying to move off the ground? It's a bunch of different people.
It's from the newbie who doesn't understand the things that we've discussed, all the way to the experienced directors who have worked and worked on projects, been in the business for 15, 20 years, but still might not understand the producing side of things and how to package a project.
It's true. There's like a secret language to producing. Even I am still learning about the ins and outs of this secret language that they've got, you know, and obviously they've got little lists, you know, and if the actors aren't on the list and every actor is worth a certain amount of money this week, and they'll be worth a certain amount of money next week. And that kind of fluctuates.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
And then if you put certain actors in combination together, then that gets you, it's a financial puzzle that the producers put together so that they don't take a bath when they make your movie, you know, so they want to have a floor. They want to have a concrete floor that they're not going to fall beneath and just disappear forever. They need that insurance. And that comes through who you got in your movie. And, you know, I think one of the big hurdles, like I said, is finding a producer who really understands what the potential of your project is, because those producers are the guys that are going to be able to go out there and talk to the financiers and figure out different models. And there's several different ways to skin the cat, which way is best at this time and place with this script, with this cast. So there's a lot of different elements, and it takes years to figure out this producing stuff. But anybody can figure that out. That's math. What the magic sauce is being able to recognize a really good script, you know, that has the potential to make a really good film in a way that we haven't seen 99 times. People, why are they making all these sequels, and what's all these remakes? Because it's already been proven to work. Nobody wants to take a step outside the formula, because then you're in no man's land. You're in the unknown. You know, you're like, you can't pull up the list of numbers and say, well, this movie did this and this movie did that. This was released on Labor Day and it did this. So, and there's all kinds of numbers surrounding that. What's not surrounding is when you come up with something unique enough that it becomes an unknown, then you need to fall back on these are the actors I've got. These are the parts that are available. You know, generally men mean more than women in this crazy business. You know, that I still don't understand that one, but somehow it's still a thing, you know, where a male movie star will bring more financing to a project than a female movie star in most cases. That's strange to me, but part of the bit, it's just math. It's like insurance companies, you know, they're like, we don't care. It's, you know, this many people die of car accidents on this road. Therefore, if you want to drive on it, this is what you got to pay. So.
And those rules, by the way, change daily. They change daily. These little, this little
constantly fluid. And the producers who are tuned in are monitoring those fluctuations all the time. You know, and then where you can shoot monitors, then you get your rebates. You know, everybody would go to Louisiana because you'd get this great rebate. You go to Georgia. That's why Walking Dead and all these other things shoot in Georgia. They get a tax rebate. But that's when I was shooting Hung for HBO. We'd go to Detroit for a couple of weeks. Right. Every year. We got this great rebate. But then, you know, they've played fast and loose with their rebate money and it dried up. So now you don't go to Detroit anymore. Now you go to New Jersey. it's always fluctuating.
No, it's you know, another thing I discovered, I worked on a project where there was a name actor who they brought on, and then the filmmaker was working with them, and it's the thing that financed the project. But then by the time the movie came out, that actor had diluted his value for the year, and there was 12 other movies.
By doing too many movies.
He did 12 other movies that year.
Oh. That's a lot.
That's a lot of movies. And then he went out to the district and he completely valued his name. So then the filmmaker who that was his game, he went to distributors. They're like, I already got three of his movies this year. I'm like,
right. That's a problem. You don't want to do that.
as an actor, I'm assuming you think about this as well. As an actor, you're like, I can't be in everything. Actor, because
you got to say, yeah, you can't flood the market with too much product. It's supply and demand. But some years are different than others. You know, 1 year, you know, you're like, I've got to pay off this debt. You know, I've got to do it. And then, but you know that then you're probably going to not work the next year for a while. You want to keep that supply and demand going. You also want to be, you can't work too little, because then, you know, then you're like, well, we don't know what your value is, because the last movie you had came out 5 years ago. It's a totally different business now. I don't know. And then you're a wild card and people don't really want to invest in that. But I think as an actor, one of the things that I hope that I've found some success in is choosing projects. You know, if what I hope for is that the projects that I do are at least going to be interesting. It's not going to be some shitty script, you know, mm-hmm. And by the way, I've done it, but hopefully not a lot, you know, like maybe once or twice I've done a script where I was like, oh God, I really need to pay the rent, you know, this month. So I gotta go do it. And this is the only thing that's come across the table. And by the way, thank God that it did come across the table so I can hang on to my house. That's great. But you want to have the taste to be able to choose good projects. At least they're good on page. They have a great script. They have an interesting director. Some cool people are in it. Who knows what it's going to turn into? But I choose projects based on the script and the people involved. But it's got to be something that's going to be fun for me to play and for you to watch. That I can take control of for the most part. I can have fun in a part that I'm having fun playing, and I can make it enjoyable for you to watch. Everything else might suck, but that I can pretty much get across the line. You know, the editor might fuck it up. The director might
DP somebody
where it becomes unrecognizable, but at least it starts out where that was a fun part and fun to watch.
Yeah. And there is a good friend of mine who's an actor. He's like, Alex, sometimes I got to take alimony movies. They're called alimony movies. He's like, I know they suck. They're horrible. I leave town when they get released, but I got to do what I got to do.
Too many of those, you know.
Exactly.
But as Robert Duvall said, you know, he said, one for the art, one for the condo.
Great quote. That's amazing. Now, I do have to ask you about a little short film you made called The Punisher Dirty Laundry. Which I mean, and by the way, I loved your Punisher. I loved the way you played the character. I you know, you are so amazing in that film. And when I saw the short come out, I'm like, well, the cool level of Thomas Jane just went up because he made a short film, a fan film almost. Yep. How did that come out? How did you get involved with that? How did that even get made?
I wasn't fully satisfied with the Punisher film that I did, only because I had a vision. The vision that I had of the Punisher was slightly different than the slightly comic book version that we ended up doing. And I'm proud of that film, and it's got a lot of fans. And so I'm not taking anything away from the movie. And Jonathan Hensley did a great job. You know, I think it was his first directing.
He was
a really successful writer of blockbuster films. And he wrote this, and they gave him the chance to direct it. He gave it everything I had. I gave it everything I had. So there's a lot to be said for the film, but it's more the character. I felt there was more to that character. So I was laying around one day and I came up with that story. I was like, God, you know, and somebody had said something to me at a lunch or something, you know, they said, you know, you just need something to dine out on, you know, you need something that people are talking about this week, and you dine out on it. Somebody called, hey, let me take you to lunch. You know, and I thought, yeah, all right, well, if I did a short film and I came up with a story, I thought it was great. Chad St. John, who's a wonderful writer, was a buddy of mine at the time, went to his wedding, and we were trying to get different projects off the ground at the time. And he had this terse, wonderful Walter Hill kind of style of writing, mm-hmm. that I absolutely loved. So I called him up and I said, hey, I've got this outline, you know, and this is my thing. I want to make it 10 minutes. And he wrote it. He wrote it in a weekend. And then I went to Phil Joannou, who I had worked with on a Blumhouse movie. And I said, I asked him, because Phil did a lot of commercials, probably mm-hmm. still does. He did a lot of commercials. So he had, and he shot in town a lot. So he had crew that depended on him for their livelihood. Mm-hmm. So, and Phil, of course, State of Grace. I mean, he's just a amazing, fantastic talent. And I thought, that's a great combination. And then I went to another buddy who was a producer. And I said, you know, this won't cost us very much, because Phil is going to pull in a favor from his crew, you know, on a weekend, he's going to pull in favors from, we got our crew together, we got our special effects together, we got the whole damn thing together. It all came together. And I put it together. That was sort of my first foray into producing and making projects happen. And from that led to Renegade, my company. Mm-hmm. So I'm proud of that one. Very proud of it.
It was such a fun short to watch. Now, yeah, tell me about your new project, Tropo.
Tropo. So Tropo means, it's an Australian slang word for going crazy in the tropical heat. Like when you go up north, Australia, the more north it gets, the hotter it gets in Australia, because it's mm-hmm. upside down. And the northernmost you go, the hotter it gets, until it just gets tough, the humidity. And so people literally lose their mind up there. And so they've got a word for it. It's called going tropo. It's when, you know, when you tear your clothes off and run down the middle of the street yelling like Tarzan, you've gone tropo. Mm-hmm. I thought it was a great title. It's not the title of the book. The title of the book is called Crimson Lake, mm-hmm. and it's by Candace Fox. She's a fantastic writer out of Sydney. James Patterson tapped her to co-write some books. So that's how good she is. Wow. If you're into the mystery novels, Candace Fox is definitely one to look up. The second one is called Redemption Point. Those two, and then there's a third one too. Those are great, great mystery books. Really nicely done. Why? Because they're all about character. Anybody can sort of put together a kind of a mystery. Well, not anybody, but mysteries are one thing that you can engineer. The thing that I think separates a good mystery from a great one is the characters, and that the mystery is ultimately about solving some mystery within yourself, you know? Mm-hmm. Those are the kind of character-driven material that I'm looking for, especially with Renegade. So we've got this great book, and this was about 2 years ago, and we went through the process of developing it. And you know, this was brought to us by a company, an Australian company, and they were interested in doing a co-production. And so those building blocks were already in place. We came on more of the creative end, working with the showrunner, working with the creative producers, protecting the material, mm-hmm. making sure that what I loved and what we loved about the novel actually made it onto the screen. And for the most part, we were successful. The show opened in Australia 2 months ago and did very well. And the most gratifying thing is that the fans of Candace Fox in Australia love the show. So we didn't fuck it up. So that was good. That was really good to hear. And now it's a matter of how the American audiences will respond to it. The only one of the changes we made was she's an Australian writer writing out of Sydney, and all of her characters in the novel were Australian. And the lead character is this guy, Ted Concaffey. He's a disgraced cop. He's a good detective accused of a horrible crime. And I was interested in, what does a detective do? He seeks the truth. He's a truth seeker. If he's good at it, he needs to seek the truth, right? He's passionate about it. The way I'm passionate about acting, the way you're passionate about directing, this guy's passionate about seeking the truth. And that passion, that truth-seeking thing, that inability to leave something alone, that you have to sneak in there and find out what's going on, is what led to him getting accused of this horrible crime. You know, if he had just left well enough alone, it would have just been another day. But because he's a truth seeker, it ruined his life. So the core of that is, you know, what happens when the thing that I do best, the thing that I am, ruins my life? You know, that was fascinating to me. And the other lead character is Amanda. So they've got these two leads, and they couldn't be. She is this young 20-something shaved head, tattooed, badass, crazy person who just got out of prison. She spent a decade in prison for killing her best friend in high school.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
So she's, you know, these are not two people that were going to be hanging out together in a bar at all. Mm-hmm. But because, and she got out of prison and then went back to the town where she committed the murder and opened up a detective agency. But she doesn't know how to be a detective. She hasn't done the first fucking thing about it. So she figures she sees me and knows that I am an ex-detective. And she figures, well, this guy is what I need. And they start this uneasy relationship, you know, and the only reason Ted takes the gig, he doesn't take the gig. Don't get me wrong. He's like, all right, I'll do this once. I'll go ask these questions, but that's it. He's constantly trying to get out of it. But the thing that keeps pulling him back in is that glimmer of hope, you know, that because he's a truth seeker, it's just that glimmer of being able to do what he does best. So really neat story, great characters.
And where's it going to be? And it's going to be played on, is it Freebie?
Amazon. Yeah. If you go to Amazon, and then I think there'll be a banner for Freebie. Which used to be the IMDb TV app.
Okay.
And now they changed the name to Freebie. Anyway, there'll be a banner on top of Amazon Troppo. Okay. Easy to find on Amazon.
Now I'm going to ask you a few questions I ask all of my guests. What advice would you give a filmmaker trying to break into the business today?
Run.
You know what? That advice has been said on the show many times.
Not too far from the truth. You want to be a filmmaker. Well, what you do is you make films. Mm-hmm. Don't wait around for somebody to hand you a bunch of money. A lot of folks out there are waiting around for somebody to hand them a bunch of money. A lot. I would even say maybe most.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
You want to put the pedal to the metal, put your money where your mouth is. You know, and Coppola said this years ago. I remember Coppola giving a great speech about, and this was right at the dawn of cell phones, you know, right at the dawn. I think it was, the iPhone 1 had just come out, and he goes, you got one of these? You got no excuses. I mean, he was blown away by the technology. And he's right. I mean, there's a great film called Tangerine, all shot on the iPhone.
Yeah, Sean Baker.
Soderbergh shot on the iPhone. Look, you got no excuse. You want to make, if you're a filmmaker, where's your film? Where's your film?
If you're a painter, where's your painting?
There it is. And it doesn't even have, you know, you don't even need actors. I mean, one of the greatest movies I've seen in a long time was called The Bear.
The 89. I remember very well.
It's a French film.
Such a good movie.
It is a bear. It's about a bear and a baby bear. And it's their adventures through the wild. It's absolutely gorgeous. You know, you should be able to tell a story with rocks with smiley faces on them. You know, I'm not kidding.
Agreed.
Be able to tell a compelling story with emotion and everything you want to get across using sock puppets. Okay? So there's no excuse. There's never an excuse, you know, and it's fun. The challenge of it is amazing. And then, you know, and then you got the puzzle. How am I going to come up with something that people want to watch and that people maybe haven't seen before? Or how am I going to come up with something that they have seen before, but I'm going to do it better than anybody else? It's a potpourri of delights out there right now. And you can do it with just whatever's in your house, you know, the computer, the phone. Off to the races. It really is fun. There's a really neat, I wonder if I got it here. Not sure. Is this it? No, that's a lighter. There's a really neat lens that came out a couple years ago. That's a 2.35. Mm-hmm. You slip it onto your iPhone. Have you seen that?
Oh, it's amazing. No, it's amazing.
It's really well done. It's not cheap, and it's well ground. The lens is really well ground, and it'll give you that widescreen format on your phone.
No, it's amazing.
Oh, yeah, I had fun playing with that for a long time.
And two last questions. What is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film industry or in life?
Oh, my God. What are hard lessons to learn? You know, I guess one of the hardest lessons to learn is that I'm good enough.
That exact answer has been said multiple times on the show.
Well, it's true. Mm-hmm. I, as an actor, I got to tell you, it took me a long time to become an actor that I would want to watch. You know, that I had problems. I had problems being in front of the camera. I had problems being on set. I was nervous. I was I had the imposter syndrome. I had a real difficulty calming down enough so that I could concentrate enough and relax, so that I could do what I wanted to do, because I'd be great in my bathroom and rehearse and all the lot, you know, and I knew the character that I wanted to bring to life, but it wasn't coming out. You know, it's just like, that is not what I saw when I was laying on my couch daydreaming about what this part was, you know, or doing my research. And it took me a long time to be able to relax and you know, and part of that is sort of a, you know what, this is what I got, you know, and that is liberating.
And last question, three of your favorite films of all time.
Oh my gosh. Three of my favorite films
that come to mind today.
Oh, come on. Right. They come to mind today. Well, I've got to mention the Samurai films right now.
So that counts as one.
Yeah. Samurai 1, 2, and 3. There's three. There you go. But I'd call that one movie. Mm-hmm. You know, now you're going to have me kicking myself later on. Okay, here's a great film you should check out. Blast of Silence. You heard of that one?
No, I have not.
I'm a real big fan of noir. This is a late noir. It was low budget. If you guys are all filmmakers out there, you got to check out Blast of Silence. Okay. I think this guy maybe directed one or two things, and I can't remember his name, unfortunately. But black and white, early 60s, so late noir period, crime movie called The Blast of Silence, or just Blast of Silence. I think even Criterion might have put that out.
I'll look for it.
All right. There's two, right? Mm-hmm. And let's see, number three. You know, I mean, the movie that has stayed with me and changed my life and made me want to, that changed my life was Alien.
Oh,
Alien changed. I was 8 years old, right? And I always say, I think I've said this in 100 interviews, but people ask me, and so that's the truth. But I was 8 years old. My folks, you know, they didn't have money for a babysitter, so they'd drag us kids. My sister was only five. You know, but that movie made a huge impression on me. I got the booklet. My dad, I made my dad buy me the, they used to, hand sell these books, and it was full of information and pictures. I took that to school and I told all, because my buddies were not going to see Alien. You know, their parents were not taking them to Alien. So I acted out the whole movie for all my friends over and over again. And that was the beginning.
Thomas, it's been an absolute honor and privilege talking to you, my friend. Thank you so much for entertaining us for all these years. And I'm so looking forward to seeing all the new projects you do with Renegade and the stuff that you're doing in the future, my friend. Thank you again. And thank you for being so honest and raw and forthcoming about all this information. Hopefully it's going to help some filmmakers out there. So I appreciate
it. I hope so, buddy. It was great talking to you. Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
I want to thank Thomas so much for coming on the show and dropping his knowledge bombs on the tribe today. Thank you so, so much, Thomas. I hope this episode has opened your eyes to what is really needed in today's market to cast a bankable star like Thomas Jane and many other actors of his caliber. Now, if you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, including how to see Thomas Jane's new project, Tropo, head over to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/580. And if you haven't already, please head over to filmmakingpodcast.com, subscribe, and leave a good review for the show. It truly helps us out a lot. Thank you again so much for listening, guys. As always, keep that hustle going. Keep that dream alive. Stay safe out there, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast at IndieFilmHustle.com. That's IndieFilmHustle.com.